そう。
So our goal this morning is to go through Daniel chapter 2, and for my personal goal is to make sure I don't trip over these cords. I think if we accomplish those two, we should be in pretty good shape. Before we begin, we were asked about schedule, because I mentioned to somebody that we weren't just going to be covering Daniel, but also a couple other books as well. So, and see, obviously, we'll be starting out going through the book of Daniel, and then mid-December, once we get done with Daniel, we're going to go through a couple lessons on the intertestament period between the testaments. And then we'll cover the book of Ecclesiastes, which is conveniently also 12 chapters. And then we'll spend a single lesson on Song of Solomon. And then try to give one last review of all of this. Before we actually get into chapter 2, let's do a very sort of brief review of chapter 1. Who was taken by Nebuchadnezzar? Yeah, what was the group that kind of as a whole that was taken?
10,000 nobles?
Yeah, well, it was the young nobles, the kings, some of their some of the king's family. And what special purpose were some of them taken out?
Educating their...
Yeah, they were going to be educating them, but they were going to specifically serve in some way. They were going to serve to the king, right? And we discussed this, but and why was that important for these to be trained this way?
So that the king could be aware of, he wanted people from the culture, from that group of people that were taken.
Yeah, certainly. He's going to have this empire with this as part of this. So they can, and it's both ways, learning about them and also to combine the culture in, so to speak. So what did Daniel and these others, specifically that were mentioned of, what did they take exception, what did they have a problem with?
Food and drink.
Yeah, they didn't want to defile themselves with food and drink. Mm-hmm. And so they proposed a test, some way they could be tested to show that this worked. What was this test?
10 days of water and...
yeah, and...
Faith.
And afterwards, what was the result of that?
They were better.
Yeah, so they were above all these other ones. Perfect. And matter of fact, it even says that they were better than all these other magicians and others. And this may come into play in our next into chapter 2. Now, right there at the very beginning, we might have a problem. Look at that first verse. And consider something that we kind of looked at before, but I want to take a moment to look at it again, specifically as it relates to this chapter. First verse says, "Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him." Now, how many years was the training?
Three years.
Three.
So, how did they have 3 years of training in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar? Yeah, exactly. And we talked about this. The first year under the Babylonian system, the way they dated it, and I know it may be 606, depending on who you learned it from or where you use, but 605 BC, the ascension year of Nebuchadnezzar. Apparently, I'm going the wrong direction. And then we see the first year of the reign, the second year of his reign. So we could have had 3 years. Plus, they were actually taken before he technically was king. Okay, so as we know from the title of our book there, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And what was special about this dream? About to answer my own question, this dream we read bothered him in some way. So much so that we are read his sleep left him. So he called all these people, and why did he call these people? We know it troubled him, but what was he looking for?
Interpretation.
Yeah, he was wanting to know what this...
First, he wanted them to tell him what his...
Well, get ahead of me. I'll get there in just a moment. So there's these four groups, though, that it mentions. The magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans. And the magicians were perhaps how we kind of think of them today, except that they might have been said that these tricks were actually supernatural, perhaps whereas today we realize, you know, that our magicians are performing tricks, but they might have had perhaps some of the same, doing some of the same things. But of course, without knowing the science behind it or whatever, might seem something a little more to it. Astrologers. Babylonians, from my reading, knew quite a bit about astronomy, and so, and with their pagan beliefs, astrology was part of this. And the sorcerers, from this verse, which kind of relates to the soothsayers, which we'll see in verse 27. And the Chaldeans are wise men, and I'm going to kind of use the term wise men twice in two ways, because wise men were also used for these groups as a whole. I'm going to try to use that, apparently. Okay. So, verse 2 through 11, he tests them. And as you were saying, what was their test?
He was supposed to tell them what the dream was.
Yeah, they...
They wanted him to tell the dream.
Yeah.
He didn't know.
He wanted them to. And with that, what's so difficult about that?
We can't do it.
Well, yeah,
if they're just going to say the answer is the interpretation, they could make up anything.
Yeah, exactly. You say, this means this and this means that. Yep, and they could pick whether or not, you know, they could tell them something good, something bad, doesn't really matter, and, you know, maybe later he wouldn't even notice. But it's interesting. They tell him, hey, tell us the dream in verse 4. In verse 5, my decision is firm. If you don't make known to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut to pieces, and your houses shall be made an ash heap. However, if you tell me the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation. So, does that seem kind of on the spot a little bit, aren't they? You think that was a fair for him to put a test like this to these guys?
Well, if they were who they claimed to be and had the powers that they...
Plus, it gave Daniel an opportunity to do a good job.
Right, and certainly we realize that, you know, throughout this thing, you know, Daniel, you know, they've been praying God, they're following God, and obviously there's going to be a door open in a moment that we're going to see. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Was this fair? Well, A, he's the king. I mean, you know, we're talking about a king in this powerful nation. You know, he certainly got that ability, right. You know, if he says this, it happens. Which is, to me, a little bit interesting considering that Babylonians had a code of law, but and perhaps were even considered just. But, he, you know, was it fair? Yeah, if they claim to have all these powers, you know, they're claiming these, whatever they've, you know, prophecies or whatever, interpreting different things and different signs, then, yeah, you know, mm-hmm. Seems like a fair test to ask one to be able to prove themselves before he does this. And perhaps, you know, this is even kind of wise on his part to propose such a test, you know, because, let's see what verse. Verse 8. Let's, somebody read for me verses, 8 through 11. Go ahead.
The king replied, I know for certain that your bargaining for time, as much as you have seen that command from me, is firm, that if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who could declare the matter. For the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician or conjurer or Chaldean. You want 11 as well?
Yeah.
Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there is no one else who could declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh.
So they admit that they couldn't do this. Is that kind of a problem? And we've kind of already said it, but isn't that kind of a problem, you know, for them to say, you know, we can't do this and that it's up to the gods? I mean, didn't they speak, you know, these are people that supposedly, you know, could tell all these things that, you know, interpret things from their gods or whatever, and yet they're saying only the gods can tell you. Mm-hmm. Of course, what does that kind of open the door for, too, and later on? Yeah, exactly, Daniel with the one true God. Mm-hmm. And so, in verse 12, the king was angry and very furious and gave the command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. So apparently, you know, they were at that point with their training to be part of these wise men. Okay, so he gives this order out of anger. You know, obviously the dream's been troubling him. He hasn't been able to sleep. You know, he told him what would happen, and now, you know, he's having to go through with it, or he is going through with it. One thing I think that's worth noting is in verse 9, for you have agreed to speak lying, corrupt words before me until the time has changed. So what was he basically saying there?
They were just lying to
me. Yeah, you're lying to me, you're trying to buy time. Yeah, you're just going to, you know, maybe I'll cool down, maybe things will change or something more important will come up, and then I won't remember this, and, you know, we'll go on about it. But obviously that wasn't the case. Obviously this had a greater purpose than was, and Nebuchadnezzar knew it. Okay, so Daniel hears of this decree. Let's see, verse 4. So he asked in verse 15, you know, why is this decree so important? And it was made known to them. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. And then he goes to his house and tells the others. So apparently the king did give him time. Why would the king give Daniel, you know, time to go back and figure something out?
Well, yeah, and
You know, this is apparent a little bit later, you know, and that's, I think, perhaps the biggest thing is, you know, somebody comes up to you and says, hey, well, and says, you know, I might be able to help, you know, let me go back and, you know, pray about it or whatever he said, and we'll see if we can't answer this. So, obviously, you know, he's pretty much perhaps lost all hope at this point. You know, he's got to the point where he's just saying, kill these wise men. He's angry. He doesn't know what's going to happen, you know, but it's still apparently bothering him. Perhaps he had cooled down a little bit. Maybe it seems like he was pretty furious at the time, but perhaps he'd cool off a little bit. Perhaps something in chapter 1, what was different about Daniel and his companions that we mentioned a few minutes ago?
Well, he found Daniel and his companions 10 times better than the others, and it seemed as if this first interaction, Daniel wasn't involved. Mm-hmm. So knowing he had already examined Daniel and found them to be 10 times better, and Daniel comes in and says, give us a little time. Yes, he was more willing to do that.
Yeah, perhaps that has something to do as well. If he's, you know, been seen as, you know, wiser than these others, perhaps that had something to do with it as well, that okay, well, you know, he did seem pretty smart, let's give him a chance. And when you're hopeless, I mean, let's try something else and see what happens.
He wasn't haughty. It says how he went to the captain. He went with discretion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the others were a little bit rude when they were speaking to Nebuchadnezzar. They almost challenged him.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point as well, is that if Daniel goes in there with this, and, you know, apparently they're like, well, they just kept saying, give us the dream, well, and we'll do this, you know, it can't be done. And then if Daniel comes in there and says, well, you know, let me see if I can't do it, but I need a little time, you know, you're right, I think there was a different attitude. I'm sure there was a little bit of a different attitude with these. And I don't know, perhaps they were bluffing, I'm not sure, thinking that he wouldn't go through it. I mean, with this king, I don't think anybody would doubt that he would do whatever he said he was going to do. Okay, so, verses 16 through 23. Somebody else read for us, 16 through 23, please.
So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever. For wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you. For you have made known to us the king's demand."
So we see that, verse 18, that they might seek mercies from God. And the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So the secret was revealed to them. And here we can see, you know, God's working through Daniel to reveal us to him. And they think it's interesting that they were seeking mercy, realizing what was going to happen to them too, because they were right there in line too, being considered as part of the wise men. And I also think it's worth noting that Daniel prayed and give thanks. You know, here their back is up against the wall. There's, you know, who knows when the king's going to get upset and say, "Oh, that's enough time. Go find that guy. You know, bring him in here. Drag him in here. You know, I'm done with this. You know, I gave him a chance. You know, it's been too long. Whatever." And yet, they take the time to pray to God, and granting right there in the prayer, realizing that this was coming from God, that God was giving them the wisdom, that God was giving this. And praising God and thanking him. And, you know, how easy could it be, you know, when you're in, you know, a tough situation, not anything like, perhaps like our backup like that, being drugged by a king or potentially being, you know, head lopped off or something. But, you know, how easy it is for we get a prayer answer to just, you know, say, "Oh, thanks God, and on to the next thing, appreciate that," you know, and kind of just going on about it. But he, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, I think sometimes looking at prayers in the Bible, how different it is perhaps, I know, than I pray. You know, I mean, they give these ornate prayers, you know, and just really, and it's not like it was, you know, fanciful words or anything. I mean, I think this was, you know, heartfelt, that this was, you know, just the way it was. And we know that from that prayer was obviously important in these people's lives. So that's always interesting to me sometimes to look at the prayers that were prayed, particularly in these tough situations they were faced with.
And John, we don't know. We have not read of any time where Daniel interpreted dreams before. But at least from verse 17 of chapter 1, which says, "As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams." It's something Daniel perhaps had done before. So when you approach the king, even though he is humble about it, asking God for help, he figured that it would be revealed to him.
Certainly, and obviously God had already helped them through this one thing already, this one test they had been through, with obviously with confidence that it would work out. So I don't think you're right. I mean, I hadn't made that connection. But yeah, it's certainly possible that was already there. Okay.
I think.
Sorry, go ahead.
I think what's so notable about Daniel was his humility. And I think it's important that we recognize sometimes when we do things, you know, we like to say, you know, "Look what I've done." You know, there's a lot of that kind of attitude, particularly in today's society. You know, "I did it," not giving credit that God gave us the ability to be able to do the thing that we do. And he authors that he demonstrated that he made sure that it was known that it was not he, it was the abilities that God had given him. Mm-hmm. And he acknowledged that too, that,
right,
that these things that God gave him.
And we'll get that here in just a moment as well. And going to your point, kind of skipping ahead just a few verses, we'll get to it in just a moment. So Daniel goes in and, you know, tells the king, don't destroy the wise men. You know, I will tell the king the interpretation in verse 24. He tells this to Arioch, who was the one who was been appointed to destroy the wise men. Mm-hmm. So he goes up to the executioner, basically the person who's executing this order, and says, "Hey, don't tell him, wait on this. I can tell." So it tells in verse 25 that Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said to him, "I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation." Perhaps reminding him who this guy was, you know. And, of course, the king asks him, you know, "Are you able to make known to me the dream which I've seen and its interpretation?" And going to your thing, this next couple of verses. Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, "The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these." And it goes into the description. Let's see. We'll go in another couple of verses. "As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, the secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes, who make known the interpretation of the king, that you may know the thoughts of your heart." So, like you say, he's contributing this to God. He's not taking any credit for this, even though, you know, Daniel was apparently, and his companions were apparently wise, had understanding, yet he gives credit to God and makes it clear that it's, that Daniel's just sort of the mouthpiece here. So, before we get into the actual dream, the interpretation for a moment. You know, when we look at symbolism in the Bible, when we're trying to understand, you know, sense the Bible as a whole, you know, there's some things that we have to kind of keep in mind, or that I think are kind of, I guess, say, sort of tips for helping us to understand, or when we're trying to look at this, because particularly later on, some of these things are going to be really kind of, we're going to have some, you know, I don't know if weird's the right thing, but some sort of wild imagery that we're going to be looking at and trying to figure out, you know, what does this mean? And if you were in the Ezekiel class, we got started with that very first chapter, you know, wheels and eyes, and, you know, so when we're looking at this, you know, we've got to kind of, before we get too far, I think it's important to kind of perhaps set some ground rules, so to speak. First of all, perhaps the, you know, obvious one, or hopefully it's obvious to us, you know, Let the scripture speak. Let them define themselves using the context. You know, if a scripture says, you know, and I saw this, and it's, and then we're told later it symbolizes, you know, this is what it means. You know, we don't, you know, obviously we shouldn't go off and say, well, it means this instead. If the scripture's defining itself, or if it's giving us some context to allow us to help us to understand it, we should use that. Obviously, looking at the story as the Bible as a whole often helps us as well, and not just focusing on one little piece that goes along with context. This is something that we talked about in the Ezekiel class. The Strawkar mentioned was we should try, if something's, when we're reading through it, we shouldn't just wildly go off and say something symbolic when it's obviously literal. You know, we should, you know, that would kind of be like, you know, going in here and saying, well, you know, there never was a King Nebuchadnezzar, there was Daniel. You know, if you start going off and trying to, you know, put it where it's not there, where it's obviously the case that it's meant to be a story or something literal, then we should try to go with that. But, you know, sometimes some things just can't possibly fit. If I said, you know, 1,000 people came through this doorway at the exact same time, or said, I had a dream or something, and it was 1,000 people coming through the door at the exact same time, shoulder to shoulder. Well, how is that going to fit? You know, there may be something more to it than what I'm saying. And this actually kind of ties in, and hopefully that may not be the best comparison, but we'll actually get into some of the passage. Don't place requirements that aren't there. And this will come out with this one when we look at perhaps another views of it. You know, if I say, you know, 1,000 people walked through that door, and that's all I said, 1,000 people walked through that door. Well, you can't put on the regulation that they walked through the door, you know, side by side or something, because I didn't say that. It's a requirement you're adding on that maybe wasn't in my actual statement. So give me a short description of what the vision was that we see in this passage. What did he see?
Statue.
Okay.
What? Is that short?
Well, I guess that's a relative term, right?
Actually, it was a tall statue.
Well, okay, so what were the components of the statue, and what happened to the statue?
Head of gold, fine gold.
Okay.
Shoulders of silver.
Silver, gold, iron, belly, thighs of bronze.
Okay.
Legs of iron.
Legs of iron. What were the feet?
Iron and clay.
Okay. So here's a picture trying to attempt to show, you know, what this thing might look like. Obviously, we have no idea, and that's why it's probably kind of roughed out, something that he saw. So we see these different parts of this. And we'll just pop this all at once. We're told right there in the actual passage, in in verse 38, let's read 37 and 38. You, O King, are King of Kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand, and has made you ruler over all of them. You are this head of gold. So, from the actual passage, we know at least what one of these was right from here, because it tells us he was the head of gold. Mm-hmm. And going into context, and this was discussed in your workbook, but the next part, the Medo-Persian Empire. Obviously, that was the next great empire. We see that even within here, that was the next one up after Babylon. But when we go into some of the other visions, this will also help us clarify this when we're talking about other kingdoms. Bronze, the Greek Empire. And the fourth kingdom, you know, as we say, the legs of iron, the Roman Empire. And his feet and toes of iron and clay, a mixture of clay and iron. One of the things about the Roman Empire was, you know, there was always this mix of different countries within it, and even within the Roman legions at some point in their history, perhaps later on than what we're talking about, was mixture of all these different nations within them, and there really wasn't the greatest cohesion between all of these. One thing that, I can't remember if it's mentioned in the workbook or somewhere else, but it mentions specifically the toes, and some people make something out of that because of 10 toes. It's not mentioned here. There are some things where we'll talk about 10 later and 10 kings later on in the book, but right here that's not actually specifically mentioned, and therefore I think that trying to read anything else into that, you know, it's going a little too far for this, at least within the context of this passage. So we've got this, he sees this vision of the statue, and what happens to it?
A stone came from nowhere.
Stone came
from? Wasn't built from hands. Shattered its feet. It fell and shattered.
Yeah, let's read verse, let me see, verse 34. You watched while stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. The iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found, and the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Okay? So what was the stone? What was the stone that struck the statue?
Cornerstone.
Cornerstone.
Chief cornerstone.
Okay. Keep on.
Jesus.
Yeah. So, obviously, this, stone was cut out without hands, and struck the feet and grew into a mountain. So obviously, there's something a little different here. It's not part of the statue. It's not part of this statue of these different things. It's something that's something very different, and we'll get into that later, hopefully, if we have time. Some of these things that, you know, it was called out, it's not a human kingdom insofar as, you know, it's not like these other ones. It's obviously something different. It's not going to be knocked down. It's something that's going to remain. Okay. As we, Mark chapter 9, going to it, this kingdom came with power that we're talking about. Christ sits on the throne, and Christ was made head over all things. So once again, we're looking at the Bible as a whole to see, you know, what could this be? And would you say that that there was power in God's kingdom even when it struck the statue, so to speak? You know, when did it get started? Got hints on the board with the passages, but when did this stone strike? When was this kingdom started?
Genesis.
Well, true. In a sense. And when did it hit the Roman Empire, we might say?
When Christ was crucified.
No. When Christ was crucified on the day of Pentecost. I mean, that seems like a pretty powerful thing.
Well, you could say that John the Baptist came preparing the way. Mm-hmm. And it came with great power because Jesus is following behind him, fulfilling what John said, and working miracles. His apostles are working miracles as well. So there's a great demonstration of power, mm-hmm. even before Christ dies on the cross.
Yeah. And as we'll see in a moment, it's pretty important to consider that this was a very powerful thing, and that this was, like I said, very different from these others. And would you say that that, you know, Christianity, that it was a mountain, that it's grown since that time?
Absolutely.
Well, where is the Roman Empire now? It's history. You know, yes, there is a city of Rome and there is Italy, but this is not the Roman Empire. It broke down a long time ago. It didn't last forever. No, did any of these last? I mean, how are these kingdoms present? Do we still have a Grecian Empire the way they did back then when Alexander was going around, you know, going, you know, all over the known world out to Italy, all the way out to India and wherever else he went? Does that empire still remain?
No.
Okay. What about the Medo-Persian Empire?
No.
Outside of the Bible or your ancient history class, you know, how do you know about the Medo-Persian Empire? Is that something you talk about, you know, the global economics and the Medo-Persian Empire today? No. Okay. And the Babylonian Empire, what about them?
I'm in your ancient history books.
Yep, their ancient history. Something that I thought about, if I could find the right verse. Verse 39. After Babylon, it says, after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over the whole earth. Medo-Persian Empire was a very strong, very powerful empire. You know, how were they inferior to Babylon? I mean, it says it was inferior. How could that be?
Well, the verse even before, when he says, for God has given your kingdom power and strength. I mean, and wherever children of men dwell, beasts of the field. Nebuchadnezzar had power like was never seen before. When you've gone through Ezekiel, and we saw all the other nations were placed under Babylon, he had total power. Maybe in terms of the area that was covered is not as big as maybe what Assyria had, but Nebuchadnezzar was just unique in the amount of power that he had. The Medo-Persian, they had a lot of clout too, but not as much as what he had. But I guess what is key to that, in spite of all that, when that stone that hit that statue, God was going to set up his kingdom, and it's not going to be like anything that you have seen before. Babylon is gone, Medo-Persian is gone, the Grecian is gone, even Rome, but God's kingdom is like a mountain still growing.
When I read some of the things, and I play devil's advocate a little bit whenever I read some of these different things, because also in our discussions, sometimes, you know, a lot of people don't view things like we do. And this is one of the things that I actually read brought up, not necessarily with a good answer in opposition to this, but, you know, these massive empires, you know, how could they be inferior? Well, how do we gauge strength in a nation? Is it just purely military power? Economic power? How about
combination of both?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can consider it. And the Babylonian power, ever heard of Hammurabi's Code of Laws?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Babylonian Empire there was other aspects in which they were strong as well. It's not just purely their military power. And of course, you know, that perhaps is a bit of a, you know, side note to the greater message of this passage. But I did want to bring it up because some of the things I've read, people, you know, contesting things in Daniel. Okay. I'm going to come back, actually, to this, because I think we'll have a little bit of time left, about some of the some other issues that people have raised with this passage. But let's go ahead and finish out the last few verses of this. Somebody read verses 46 to 49.
Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and an incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, "Truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, and a chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Also Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king.
I think, Nebuchadnezzar was, converting over to Judaism at this point and saying, you know, get rid of all the statues, get rid of all the stuff, you know. You know, because, I mean, he says, you know, truly your God is the God of gods.
But that was not incompatible with his beliefs. The quote that I put up on the overhead on last Sunday, I think it was, the quote that was to be read yearly about Marduk referred to him as Lord of Kings. You know, you should see that same phrase here. But yet Marduk, even among them, was not considered the only God. They held a number of gods, they believed in.
And obviously, we'll get into it next time. Obviously, you know, there was, you know, the multiplicity of gods and setting up images, and we'll get into how to a strong extent, obviously, next time. So Daniel and these others are set up. Sort of raise it up into another position after this point, based upon this. Keep hitting it, but I'll hit it one more time. So you think that there was anything behind the scenes going on, perhaps some divine intervention perhaps going on with this whole thing?
Oh, absolutely. You know, God, I'm sorry, God had told them, he said, go to Babylon for your own good, and I will protect you there. God has spoken to kings before in dreams and given them the meaning. He spoke to Abimelech when Abimelech had taken Abraham's wife, not knowing that she was married, because Abraham had said he was her brother. God spoke to kings and told them the meanings in the past. Why, in this one case, did he not tell them the meaning? Well, I think clearly, for the good of his people, he arranged for Daniel to give this dream so that his people would have the protection of the king. This was for the good of his people, and as a witness to all the nations, who really is the God of gods, the Lord of kings. Yeah.
And we've seen throughout, especially been in the other classes, you know, kings and God using the different kings and nations passing, you know, seems just like, you know, normal, you know, passing world events, but obviously there's something more going on. Before I get into some things about the visions and the interpretation stuff and kind of backtrack, is there any questions about anything else anybody wants to bring up with us about the actual text, what we've looked at so far? Okay. There's a lot of different views. If you read or if you talk to people about this passage, you know, it's kind of interesting, and I was actually talking about this studying with a couple other people Friday morning, and the guys have been starting to read Daniel. That's the background and some different views on Daniel. And you know, it's funny how, you know, when you're a kid or whatever, you know, it's almost like Daniel's six chapters, really, you know, but there's so much more to this, and even obviously within, before you even get that far, there's some different views, and people will try to make these things fit some other view they have or some view they've come up with. And so that's kind of what I want to look at this. So we've got our, you know, little image there, that this vision he's seen. One view puts forward that, yeah, that we'll agree with you on these first, all the way down to the legs of iron. Then some would say, well, no, this feet of iron and clay, that's not, you know, that's not part of the Roman Empire. That's something totally different. This has got to be World War II Germany, or it's got to be the EU. I think EU is one that I saw some people like, that's kind of a little bit vogue now, because they say, well, there's this conglomeration of nations, and they're really, because they're really kind of from the Roman Empire, it's all the culture that came out of that, and it's a conglomeration. They're going to become this, you know, world empire or whatever they're going to become. There's probably a dozen different ones they picked, but I think that was one of the ones that seems like kind of in vogue right now to use. Well, I kind of have a lot of problems with that, just practically speaking. Is the EU part of the Roman Empire? Did they come directly out of the Roman Empire?
No.
I mean, how far apart was the European Union from the Roman Empire? I mean, what, thousands of years or something?
It's kind of the same location. I think they're using that.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, they were probably, you know, Germany was probably in vogue back then because they were an empire and it looked like they were going to take over the whole world at one point or something. But, you know, we can move forward. But the other thing is, okay, we got legs of iron. What do we have down here in the feet? Iron and clay. So why is this iron so different from this?
Well, the empire was able to dominate the whole world, whereas Rome, the Romans, they conquered it, but they never did assimilate the different nationalities into their culture and their religion.
Yeah, and if you look...
it was not strong, and it was weak within.
Yes.
There was corruption. And
yeah, certainly. So, you know, just because of the connection of these two, I have trouble, obviously. And the other thing is, okay, you've got, these empires were basically back-to-back, right? I mean, you had the Medo-Persian Empire kind of took over, and so on. These things were, you know, were close to one another. Why is there, you know, that big of a gap in these suddenly? You know, it seems like that doesn't kind of fit how quickly some of these were going together. Briefly, some other things. Some will say also that the stone isn't the church, isn't it? Isn't God's kingdom? It's something different. They'll say because the church wasn't supernaturally formed. the stone was cut out. Obviously, there's some supernatural power involved in that, right? I mean, we're talking, we says, you know, cut out without hands. Well, okay, we already talked about it, but okay, wasn't there something supernatural about a guy rising from the dead, or people speaking in tongues that, you know, were fishermen and didn't have been trained in that? I don't see how you can say that there wasn't supernatural power involved when obviously there was miracles and different things involved. They'll say, well, the stone strikes at the end of history. It's striking at the feet. See, right there, the feet. It's the end of history. You know? Well, of course, that's part of the problem why they can't say Nazi Germany anymore, I guess. But but does this passage say it's the end of history?
No.
No. That's what I was talking about, adding stuff that isn't there. The passage doesn't say it's the end of history. It doesn't give anything in there that would make you say this has to be the end of history. And also, I wonder why that, since the stone rises up and stays, that seems to be a little problem there. It says the rise of the kingdom will be sudden. First of all, going back to these, were these empires sudden? Did they suddenly pop up out of nowhere? One day they're there, one day they're not. And I mean, it took a little while, right? I mean, for even if you do say these. And so that's kind of a problem anyway. And didn't Christ kind of, people weren't really looking for him, right? It was kind of coming out of nowhere. And this, all of a sudden you've got guys speaking in tongues and preaching something new. So even if you say, well, that was kind of sudden, well, that was kind of quick too. It got going pretty quick, 3,000 people, right? And they'll say, well, the stone can't be spiritual. It can't be largely a spiritual kingdom, can't be largely spiritual aspects, because these weren't. What's the problem with that? Probably a bunch.
Kingdoms of men, not kingdoms of God.
What's that?
These are kingdoms of men, not the kingdom of God.
Yeah, within the passage, did that passage make it sound to you like that this stone was just another kingdom? If it had been our kingdom, why wouldn't it be, a pedestal below the other ones or something? Yeah, it's something totally different. The passage makes it clear that they're different. It's car, spiritual kingdom is separate. There's supernaturally formed. You know, there's something more going on here. The Mormons believe yet another one, the Roman Empire. This one, I'm not sure if I even understand their logic necessarily. But I've got a quote here, I think from one of their writers, or I think I quoted from somebody who quoted from one of their writers, that this stone rose up. The feet were the European kingdoms in the 1800s, this being before EU, and that believed that the stone that rose up was, the stone was when the Church of Latter-day Saints was formed. And I didn't realize until I was researching for Daniel that they even took this stance, it was even part of their thing, but it's kind of key because it allows them to kind of say, well, see, the church started with, if that stone was the church, and that's what rose up, and that's what's going to remain. So it's almost like they're trying to restart, but it doesn't fit the context. Once again, 1830s, I don't think, there was any kind of, Roman Empire. Matter of fact, I should have looked at my world history a little better, but that would have been what, maybe Austro-Hungary? I'm trying to remember. But, point is, it can't be that. This grew up, this does not fit the context of the other ones. For some of the same reasons we already looked at.
And how did that strike the European tribes and break it apart?
Yeah, very good point.
It didn't.
Yeah, I don't see how that really struck and kind of grew up, how it struck it at all, really. I don't know when it got a foothold in Europe, when that belief did. But either way, I don't think it's, any kind of obviously hitting the other one.
All these other kingdoms literally ruined the world.
Yeah.
And the only thing close that came to ruin the world after that was the British Empire.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very good point, too, that all these that we're talking about, European Union or these other ones, don't fit that criteria as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll do your next